Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. Joining us right now will be Jeet here from The Nation magazine. But before we grab him, I said to Jeet, please forgive me. There's so much on my plate that I want to at least do an opening salvo for the show. And I've been thinking a lot about Donald Trump being in the courthouse. And this is like really the first time he's ever had to sort of face justice. I mean, real justice. And I wrote the following. What I wrote was this morning on Facebook. I wrote, Trump will spend most of spring in a drab county courtroom sitting on a hard wooden seat. Ah, there'll be no wealth porn or Diet Coke in sight. And really, he has never had to be in this kind of position in his whole life. This has been a person of incredible, incredible privilege. And I just want you to know what that means. And that means he's never, I mean, I think even when he went to prep school, he didn't have to sit in a hard chair. So my friend was commenting on what I had posted on Facebook and says, guess what, Arnie? I'm in the courthouse next door as we speak, and I'm sitting by an open window. So I hear the motorcade pull up. There are so many police and press, I couldn't even get a good photo of the pandemonium as the whole area is barricaded and there are even giant plow trucks blocking roads off. Oh my God, the chaos of the moment. And before we get into a story about what's going on with Biden and Iran and Gaza and Bibi, I wanted to start with something that a friend of mine who is a state representative in New Hampshire posted on his Facebook page. And I read it, and he's an investigative reporter. He's absolutely brilliant. And he was saying, you know, I know about dark money, and we've been seeing the influence of dark money for years. But let me share with you something that I've never seen vis-a-vis dark money. And he wrote the following. On Friday, one of my more extreme colleagues in the House posted a thread on X. He was delighted that an out-of-state dark money group that funds elections for about 100 of New Hampshire's more extreme GOP state reps has decided to cull the herd of those who failed to please their dark overlords during this legislative session. In addition to reveling in the excommunication of the apostates, he enthusiastically calls for excommunicating even more. The bottom line, if you take the money, the message is clear. Push the voting button that we tell you to push or face the consequences. There was a time when the main purpose of calling for a roll call vote in the House was to put members of the other party on the record, not your own. But in my first terms, most of our votes on bills were either voice votes or division votes that allow legislators to vote without their vote being on the record. While you can agree or disagree with this practice, as a practical matter, it allows for some level of anonymity in voting and actually encourages bipartisanship by allowing legislators who occasionally disagree with their party to vote their conscience. However, in this session, we've consistently seen about 20 members of the GOP majority call for roll call votes on just about any bill where there is potential for a GOP legislator to vote with Dems. This isn't simply about holding their colleagues in line to win a key vote. It's also about holding them accountable afterwards with threats of primary races, loss of campaign funding, and all the other fun stuff that comes with political bullying. Oh my God. Jeet here. I just have to tell you, I'm a former state rep. Okay. And I was a state rep in the 1980s and the early 1990s. And the Republican Party was nothing like the Republican Party of today. I mean, the Republican Party of when I was a member of the legislature is more like the new Dems. Right. That's truly what they were. They were more pro-choice. They were a little libertarian. They sort of were okay on a lot of social issues, but you know, they genuflected to Wall Street and banking and insurance companies. But that's what new Dems do. Okay. So if you look at a new Dem, that was the Republican Party. The Republican Party today is so toxic. I can't even recognize it anymore. But the level of control now with dark money, and realize that we have a New Hampshire legislature, we're only 1.3 million people, we're the size of a suburb, but we have 400 legislators, Jeet. They get paid $100 a year. That means in a primary where only, you know, maybe 20% of voters show up and they're the most extreme, do you know how inexpensive it is to actually acquire the entire New Hampshire legislature? And now with this dark money, it is just, I'm just trying to explain it. Well, you know, it's just so frightening, and we're not going to be talking about that, but I just wanted you to hear it because I want people around the country to understand this isn't a New Hampshire story. This is a national story.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. They're, we're seeing this a lot. Also in the sort of congressional primaries where like a lot of Republican money channeled through AIPAC is going into Democratic primaries. And so, I mean, what people should think about that, what that means. That Republican money is shaping Democratic primaries. We're in a whole new world. World brought to us by the Supreme Court, I mean, this is, I think, one of the big problems of American politics going forward. And the more we can make people aware of this, the better.
So when he posted this story, and again, you mentioned AIPAC, because I've been mentioning AIPAC as well, that AIPAC is being the master puppeteer in the Democratic primary. Okay. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. They are channeling and funneling Republican dollars. And so, for example, I won't mention his name, but the chair of the New Dems is stepping down in New Hampshire. Okay.
Yeah.
And she basically sort of passed the torch to her anointed. Immediately within the first weekend, nobody else knew she was leaving. He obviously knew she was leaving. He raised like $250,000 in like 2 hours. Okay, that's ridiculous, right? And yet we don't even know what he stands for. Mm-hmm. We don't even know what the issues are. Part of my concern about what you were saying with AIPAC now playing in Democratic primaries and really channeling Republican money is that who's going to tell people? Who's going to be doing the investigative work? Who's going to connect the dollars and the issues to the money? And how is that going to influence people? Because again, in a primary, it is just very, very frightening because these are the master puppeteers. And unless you are completely aware and you spend enough time banging that drum so people really get it, especially with primary voters, which tend to be the most engaged, they may not know. And that's what makes it so dangerous because it's so stealth.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I this is the real danger. I mean, I do actually think that just as Democrats are trying to nationalize the AIPAC issue, at least,
good,
try to put out ads and make people aware the what the AIPAC money is and what they stand for. So we'll see if that works as a strategy.
Well, I do community radio, but I'm also on the Pacifica Network. I don't know if they can do this, but if they can figure out like a 1 minute sort of PSA that is just facts, okay, and then share them on Pacifica, people like me would run it on our show because you can't just hear it once. You need to hear it over and over again. You can't just hear it. And even if you're aware that it's happening in another state, then it suddenly makes you say, are they playing in my state? What are they doing here? And I think we need to sort of, again, connect the dots and recognize repetition is how people learn. And I'm glad to know that they're doing this, but I will now make sure that people are aware. But let me tell you who Jet here is. He is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He is host of the weekly Nation podcast, The Time of Monsters. He also pens the monthly column, Morbid Symptoms. He's the author of In Love with Art, Francois Moulet's Moulis, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Adventures in Comics, Moulis. And Art Spiegelman. And how does he pronounce his last name?
Spiegelman.
Moulis. Oh, yeah, Spiegelman. Okay.
Her name is Francois Moulet, yeah.
Moulet, okay. And you're currently writing for The Nation. So I saw your piece. What I found interesting is you slam Biden, but then you praise Biden. And in part because Biden now it's not that he's adjusting what he's saying, but he's recognizing now that with what's going on with Iran, the situation is getting that much more extreme and it really could cause a conflagration in the Middle East. Not that I think that what's going on with Gaza could also not inspire it. You write, will Benjamin Netanyahu drag America into a big Middle Eastern war? Biden is pushing for de-escalation, but Israel could still go rogue. And the de-escalation that you're talking about really in some ways has got more to do with what happened just recently with Iran. What I see with his quote unquote de-escalation vis-a-vis Hamas seems to be a little more tepid. So it's a different approach depending on who you're looking at. Share with my audience your dual analysis of Biden's actions.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, when I'm praising Biden in this column, it's almost like you're praising an arsonist who decides to put out the fire, or he decides to put out part of the fire that he
part of the fire with, exactly
because it's going too far. But I mean, the baseline is since October 7th, Biden has what was called his advisors called the bear hug strategy, and this strategy is that you embrace Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu as much as possible. And in doing so, you can guide them and help them, like avoid catastrophic decisions. The thing is, Arnie, like, okay, let's say you're dancing with a bear. Who's going to take the lead? You are the bear.
Exactly. And he is such a bear because this is about survival, like it is for Trump. It's about survival for Bibi. He'll accept the hug because it's good for him and it means he still gets support, but he's not going to basically be guided by the hug because that isn't good for his future, because his future depends on more war.
Of course, exactly. No, it's absolutely in Netanyahu's best interest, not even best interest, survival, because the minute the war stops, people are going to start asking, hey, why was Hamas allowed to launch this horrific attack on October 7th? Why was Netanyahu's government funding Hamas for many years as a part of a divide and rule policy? And Netanyahu, and he also has his own corruption issues. He will be finished, and he knows that. So it's in absolute Netanyahu's interest for the war to keep going as long as possible. And that is not in the interest of Joe Biden politically, because he's hurting because of what's happening in Gaza. It's not in America's interest, what Israel is doing. And it's certainly not in the interest of the world. But Biden followed this bear hug strategy, which I think has been a failure. And part of the argument for the bear hug strategy was, okay, we'll let them do what they want in Gaza, but we'll use our influence to avoid a larger war. Because right from the start, Netanyahu was blaming this, falsely blaming this, I'll add, on Iran to try to make this a war not just between Israel and Hamas. Or actually Israel and the civilian population of Gaza, but to make it between Israel and Iran as well. And the logic of the bear hug strategy was, we will, because we'll be giving them so much weapons and support, they will listen to us and they will avoid a larger war. Well, that has not actually happened because Netanyahu, seeing the failure, they have really failed in Gaza. They have not
They
achieved
have.
the ends that they want. Needing a knockout victory or needing a bigger war to distract from this failed smaller war, the same way, Bush launched the war in Iraq to distract from the failures in Afghanistan.
Exactly.
So the bigger war that Biden hoped to avoid has actually, it could still happen because of Israeli action, notably the bombing of the consulate, which is like a, whatever you say about the government of Iran. Like embassies and consulates are supposed to be the sacred international spaces, and it's a gross violation of international law and a provocation and designed to spark a larger war.
And he knew exactly what he was doing. Let me remind everyone what happened, because I think this is important, because I think, we heard about it, but I don't think we recall the details. And the details are, is that Israel bombed an Iranian consulate in Damascus. It killed 16 people, including an Iranian brigadier general. I mean, let's understand. Can you imagine if someone bombed and built and killed an American brigadier general? I mean, let's put this into context, everyone. But I think in a lot of ways, Bibi knew exactly what he was doing because he was so unsuccessful with Gaza. Things were being miserable, and he clearly wanted to sort of enhance what he wanted the enemy to be, which was not Hamas, it was Iran. And as a consequence, you saw exactly what Iran did. But you mentioned in your
Well,
second half
I'll add, there's
one.
not just like the bombing of the consulate. Netanyahu and Israel have been doing all these provocations of like assaults into Lebanon, the killing of this the family of like a Hamas leader that was done in Lebanon, which included not just his three sons but three grandkids, who are, I believe, ages like between 6 and 12.
Oh, God.
And so like all of this is designed to keep escalating, keep the war going. Now, at some point, Biden seems to have decided, well, and I actually want to give credit to the uncommitted movement and the protests we're seeing, because I think they've made Biden aware of the political cost of like war in the Middle East, that he does not want a war with Iran. And okay, to give credit to Biden where it's due, there was a measure of real diplomacy for the first time in this whole mess, where and what they did, and this is very interesting, is that they w created back channels to the government of Iran. Basically, Iran has a huge amount of sway in Iraq. The U.S. still has soldiers and diplomats in Iraq. They were communicating. Iraq was the middleman, and the Iranians said, Like we need to retaliate. And the Americans said, we didn't have anything to do with the bombing Damascus. Don't retaliate against us. And they communicated. And so this is why, Biden had information ahead of time, days before the attack. He was like warning an attack is coming. He knew this because the Iranians told him this. And the Iranians, everything that they did was to have like a way of saving face, to have a shore force sending these missiles, but they were drones that took several hours to get over to Israel, all just heading towards military targets. And because the Americans knew about this in advance, American allies like Jordan were able to shoot many of them down. And the American, I mean, it looks like, according to The Intercept, most of the missiles that were coming into Israel that were shot down by the United States government. I mean, and now Iran has said, well, this matter is settled. The Israelis cabinet says no, like we're gonna like retaliate. So the tit for tat could continue, but I
But
mean
does this
Biden's
give
actually.
Biden now an opportunity to step away from Bibi? Because what he did was, you talked about the back channels. You talk about the fact, I mean, this was almost like it was choreographed. I mean, it's just, it was so remarkable. And clearly it was, as Biden keeps saying, it was a win for you, Bibi. It was a win. But the all but that but Bibi doesn't want a win. He wants a war.
That's
Please
right.
understand, the first letter is the same, W, but it's not win, it's war that Bibi needs, because to win is for Bibi to lose.
Absolutely, absolutely. I would add, because there's a way danger personalizing this, that it's not just Netanyahu,
Yes.
that there are other members of the Israeli cabinet that also want a war with Iran. I think it has been in Israel's long-term strategic vision that having a war with Iran would benefit them because their Arab neighbors, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, they're not fans of the Iranian government. And so this would create a new regional bloc that they could be part of with the United States against Iran. Now, but that's not what the United States wants. I mean, I don't think Biden wants a war with Iran. And he has said, like, if they retaliate, the US won't support that. But, to go back to the bear hug strategy, everything that the Biden has done has indicated like Bibi can act against what America wants and then the US will end up supporting it, right? That has been the pattern. And that's what I'm worried about, that Netanyahu and the other Israelis will say, like, okay, they're saying they won't support us, but push comes to shove, it's us versus Iran. Who are they going to side with? So it's
And
a risk.
actually, what you're telling me is, if they were able to create this incredible back channel strategy, I think that also says that the perception, both from the Iranians, don't want a war with the US, and the US doesn't want a war with Iran. And I think both of them, in that way, there's a kumbaya going on. And the problem for the kumbaya is Bibi. Bibi is the
That's right,
problem, okay? And so that now, and yet Bibi is not just a problem for Iran and the US. Bibi is a problem for Israel, everyone. This is not good security for Israel. This is like the worst thing they could possibly do. So, in an interesting way, how do we frame this so that we can begin to create some stability in Gaza? We can begin to recognize that Bibi is not, he's an impediment. He's an impediment to everything that is about stability. And I'm just trying to figure out, how does Joe Biden do this? What do you recommend, Jeet? What is the way forward? Because this is also going to be politically, we were talking about the Democratic convention this summer. Oh my God, you know what I'm terrified of, and a lot of us are, about what it could turn into. And I just think that, as a result, he needs to figure out how to begin to resolve this before the convention, because the convention could blow up.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I think that one thing he has to do is to stop subtexting, stop having his spokespeople say, well, Biden is unhappy with what Netanyahu did, to have the other people, his ventriloquist dummies, speak on his behalf. I think that Biden needs to say in his own voice, the United States does not want a war with Iran. The United States is opposed to any provocations that will accelerate a war, that will escalate a war. We say no. And if he says it in his own voice, and not to have off the record officials tell this to NBC News, I think that would mark a big shift. And
But
I
that
mean, the
doesn't, it
early thing
doesn't
is.
resolve one of, but in a lot of ways, the one of the reasons why Bibi likes this Iran conversation is that it takes the heat off of Gaza. You know, so
Well,
we're not talking about starvation, and we're
that's the
not,
other thing.
go
And
on, go
actually, I
on.
think it's interesting in the G7
Oh.
statement that came out of this. It was like the first paragraph was condemning, Iran for, this violation of international law. But then the last paragraph was all about Gaza. We need a ceasefire. We need a humanitarian aid to go in. So, I mean, the other thing that Biden could do and say is make the Palestinians central to this. And I think this might go against Biden's own instincts and his own worldview, but he actually has to say, we can't have, this idea that the way to peace is to vanquish Iran, the way to peace is to reassert military power is not going to work. The central problem is the occupation, is the siege of Gaza, and we have to have a settlement on this. This is the only way forward, and to make that the priority. And just, what they're saying now is like, let's work towards a ceasefire, return of the hostages, and then we'll start up the two-state solution again. But what if you say it the opposite way, to say it's the fact that there has not been a two-state solution that has created this mess, and therefore we make that the priority right now, and like really commit the United States to it? I mean, if one were more radical even, and Biden's not going to do this, but you see governments like Spain and Ireland talking about, we'll just recognize the Palestinians. We will say, we recognize Palestine as a state. If Biden did that,
Oh my God,
that would
that would be
shake up.
incredible. That would be incredible. But the other thing you've
There
said,
are people in the State Department, in the American State Department, that are talking about that as a strategy.
are they
Whether they have
really?
Biden's ears, whether they
Oh my
can
God.
sway him, I don't know. But that is the path forward.
Well, think about it. What did Trump do? He recognized Jerusalem as the capital. So
That's right.
Trump can recognize Jerusalem. Guess what, Joe? You could recognize the Palestinians.
Definitely.
I mean, if sure something. And on top of that, the other thing we can't forget is the West Bank. We can't forget about the settlements. And I think that's another thing that he has to talk about, that we have been ignoring. We know that what they're doing is a violation. We've been letting them do it with a blank stare forever. And if you want to create another authority and it's not Hamas, then you have to address what's going on in the West Bank. You know,
Absolutely.
and I think that if we don't connect the dots, we will fail in providing an opportunity for something other than Hamas to be in control. And we set up Hamas. George Bush insisted upon the election between Fatah and Hamas back in 2006. It was Bush that wanted it. Fatah didn't want it. They weren't ready. And then what did we get? We got Hamas, and we haven't had an election since 2006. So guess what? We have a lot of repairing to do. And the idea of a two-state solution isn't just recognizing Palestine, it's to recognize that you've got the West Bank and you have Gaza, and you have to wed them together.
Absolutely. No, but I mean, this is really the only way forward. Otherwise, we're going to continue to stumble along, with the kind of violence that we're seeing, and we're also going to be continued to be at risk of like a wider war breaking out. I since we're talking on American radio, I want the listeners to think about this, that like, as Americans, like, it's their tax dollars that are paying for the horrors that we're seeing now in Gaza.
Yes,
If people are
yes.
starving in Gaza, that's your money that's paying for it. And but also, if there's a wider war, and we've already seen this, already American soldiers have died because of militia groups in the Middle East since October 7th. And but there'll be more. And already American soldiers were involved with this operation over the weekend. It was American soldiers who manned the anti-missile systems that saved Israel.
Wow.
But if there is more escalation, there'll be more American soldiers involved. You will see American body bags. And you have to ask yourself, as an American, like, are you committed to having your blood and treasure, your soldiers and your money go to continue what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank forever? Because that's what Netanyahu wants. And that's what the Israeli right wants.
And
So,
but you're speaking to the American people. I want you to speak to the American people. You're also inviting in President Trump. Please understand that if this happens, what you are doing is not only seeing the body and the treasure as you describe it, you are seeing the future of your country. This
that's
is
right.
about the
Absolutely.
future of America. That Putin doesn't have to drop a bomb. Iran doesn't have to drop a bomb in the US. The Chinese don't. The bomb is named Trump. And we will
Absolutely.
actually package the bomb because of what's happening in the Middle East. So I just
Absolutely. Yeah.
want
No. If there's a war in the Middle East, you will see the Democratic under Biden's watch.
Yep.
You're going to see the Democratic coalition like fall apart.
Completely.
You will see like a split that you have not seen since 1968, and it's going to be ugly. And it's going to take many years to repair. Like it will actually mean Republican power for like many years to come, with all that that entails. So.
And as frightened as I am, you will, the instability that we are talking about is like nothing you have ever seen, because Donald Trump is arming them. Donald Trump is inviting them to create a war. So this isn't just about an election. This is an election that's coupled with violence.
Yeah,
Understand that.
oh
That's
no.
what Donald Trump wants to do. They can't imagine it, Jeet, but I can imagine it. And the more you read Project 2025, not only do you, can you imagine it, but you will see that the assault will be happening everywhere. And someone said, well, Donald Trump is worried about, going into an orange jumpsuit. He's worried about this criminal trial. I said, you know what? I'm worried that if Donald Trump gets elected, I'll start being measured for an orange jumpsuit. I just want to let you know that's my fear as well. Jeet here writes for The Nation magazine. The piece that we're having a conversation about is entitled, "Will Benjamin Netanyahu Drag America into a Big Middle Eastern War? Biden is pushing de-escalation, but Israel could still go rogue." Thank you so much for doing this, Jeet. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was great to be on.
It was great. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. We'll be right back.
This Civil Liberties Minute is about school dress codes, racism, and conformity. I'm Bill Newman. Texas, like about half the states, has a Crown Act. Crown, creating a respectful and open world for natural hair, a Texas law that prohibits discrimination based on hair texture or protective hairstyle commonly or historically associated with race. But the law hasn't protected 18-year-old Darryl George, who has locks, rope-like strands that he pins on his head in a barrel roll, a protective hairstyle that reflects black culture. Notwithstanding the Crown Act, the dress code in Darryl's high school in Mont Belvieu, Texas, prohibits hair that could extend beyond the top of a t-shirt collar. The fact that Darryl has never let his hair down in school was irrelevant. And recently, the state district court judge hearing the case agreed, ruling that because the Crown Act doesn't specifically mention hair length, the school could legally discipline Darryl as it has, including suspensions and relegating him to an off-campus disciplinary program because he wouldn't cut off his locks. What lesson should we learn from this school dispute? Well, the superintendent once explained his view that, quote, being an American requires conformity. There's another significant claim in the related federal case. Because the dress code targets black male students, it violates federal civil rights law.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. So I have gotten to truly become a huge admirer of Peter Green. He writes about education, education reform. He spends his time looking all over the country, pulling these stories together. And it's like, oh, that too? Oh, that too? And it's like, I love him. And so interesting, Peter, because I'll talk to other people who write about education and they always go, well, you have talked to Peter, haven't you? And I'm like, oh, of course, of course. So you are known as a god within the education community. He spent 39 years as a high school English teacher. And today he looks at the hot new reform politics and policies, not just politics, that affect the classroom. And my favorite part of the story is that you used to live in Claremont, New Hampshire. Did you also teach in Claremont?
No. I left Claremont when I was 9.
Too bad. Well, Claremont has its issues as well. I don't know if I sent it to you. Did I send to you the comparison between Hanover and Claremont?
Yes, you did.
Hanover, New Hampshire is where Dartmouth College is. It's a very well-heeled community, very rich, whatever. And Claremont is just a struggling community. And yet they're not at the most extreme. Okay. So it's not the richest community. Hanover isn't. And Claremont isn't the poorest community. But when you looked at the amount of money that they could invest in public education, when you looked at how they were able to, what the salaries they were able to afford their different teachers, when you looked at their classroom responsibilities, when you looked at everything, you couldn't believe that we were talking about public schools in the same state, because it felt like you were looking at the bottom of the mountain and the top of the mountain, because it's no way that you could invest in kids in the same way. And then, of course, the results were going to be different. And it isn't just about the well-heeled families that live in those communities. It was about the lack of investment in the places that needed so much investment. And the fact that the wealthy were obviously, you know, had more money, more access, better paid teachers and better facilities. And it's no surprise that you get this divergent outcome. And I sent it to you just because I saw Claremont. And I said, I got to send this to Peter, because to see the numbers was to be heartbroken, Peter.
It's rough.
It's really rough. And someday I'm going to make sure that you see, there was a guy who used to do a report on PBS, and he covered education. I'm having a mind fart right now, but he would always do these reports on education. And at one point he came to New Hampshire and he found a married couple, and the married couple were both school teachers, Peter. One taught in Franklin, very poor. The other one taught in Amherst, very rich. And what he did was he followed each of them in the morning. They would sit there and have breakfast, and then they would go in different directions, okay? So they were both going to public schools. And then he would record the experience of the two of them. And to see it visually was so powerful, because it told you more than anything that a number could tell. Because the guy that was teaching in Amherst, he went to a public school that had indoor piazzas. Okay. I mean, literally it had indoor gardens. All right. I think he had a student loan of maybe 78 students in total. He only had two preparations. It was like ridiculous. And he got paid thousands more. And then his wife went to Franklin, and the gym floor had moguls in it. I mean, I think she had 140 students. I think she had 5 preparations, and she got paid significantly less. Oh, it's called the Merrill Report. That was what
John
it was
Merrill.
Called. John Merrill. It was the Merrill Report. And I just want people, we need to do those visuals again, Peter. We need for people to see it, because for you to write about it or for Arnie to describe it is one thing. But when you realize that these are both public schools and you want these kids to succeed, you're setting a group of kids up to fail. You know, it's just by definition, and yet it's through public policy that we're creating that failure. And through public policy, we could actually fix it. Anyway, let's talk about the state of the teaching profession. That makes me sad too. So tell me about what you wrote about at Forbes, because you were looking at a new Pew study that came out that talked to a lot of teachers. So why don't you share with us what's going on inside the profession?
Yeah, the Pew report, which is a survey they do every year of a few thousand teachers to see what the attitudes are and how people are doing. It's not a pretty picture right now. They found that only 33% of teachers reported being extremely or very satisfied with their jobs, which compares They also do a survey of workers in general, and general worker satisfaction is around 51%. So teachers are kind of behind the pack there. There were some surprising to me parts. Only 13% of teachers said they were not satisfied with their relationship with parents. And given the amount of strife we're told there is between teachers and parents these days, that was better than one might have expected. 3 out of 10 say they may look for a new job this year, and 69% are looking to get out of the classroom, either into a non-teaching education job or a job outside the profession entirely.
Now, can I ask a question of you before we go beyond that? So my daughter's a school teacher, and she's taught all over the world, and she's just so shocked at teaching here. She's shocked. She cannot believe how unsupported teachers are. And she's taught everywhere. She's taught in Sweden. She's taught in Norway. She's taught in Japan. She's taught in China. So, I mean, we're talking the world, not just, you know, not just Asia, but Europe and whatever. And she just said, Mom, you have no idea how bad it is compared to so many other places in the world that I've taught. And in that way, she's sort of so shocked. And you mentioned the numbers about how many people are planning on leaving the profession within maybe the next year and within the next 5 years. You mentioned that Pew does this study every year. Has the numbers, I don't know if you have these numbers at your fingertips, but has that changed dramatically? Like if you went back 10 years ago, it wouldn't be 3 in 10, it might be 1 in 10 was prepared to leave within the next year. I'm just kind of curious whether we're seeing more of a floodgate, and not only in part because of the dissatisfaction, as you mentioned, 31% were satisfied compared to 51% of them, but now with low unemployment, you can find another job. I mean, there was stability in teaching, but now the fact is that if you have any kind of skill, you can probably find a job where you'll be less harassed and feel better about yourself when you come home in the afternoon. And I'm just sort of curious if there's been a significant change in those numbers.
There's a lot of disagreement about that, and it depends on whose numbers you're looking at.
Okay.
I personally don't think it's super dramatically increased. I think it's been increasing steadily for 20, 25 years.
Yes.
And that since we started down the road of more and more so-called education reform, I think the job has been less and less appealing for a variety of reasons. I mean, nowadays, add on to that kind of the demonization of teachers post-COVID. We're seeing a stagnation of wages these days. And this is another surprising result of the Pew study. Maybe not surprising, but 77% of the teachers responding said they found the job stressful. 68% called it overwhelming, even though at the same time, and this kind of gets to the special psychology of being a teacher, I guess, at the same time, more than half also said the job was fulfilling and enjoyable. But the top reason they found in the Pew study for the stress and overwhelming nature of the job was too few hours in the day. 84% of teachers said there's not enough time in the day to get all their work done, and that they have just too many things that they have to get done in the course of the day, which, again, is not a new thing. One of the first things I ever wrote that got a big audience was a piece in 2014 that about that exact same thing, that there's just not enough. One of the things, those list of things they don't tell you in teacher school, they don't tell you how much you're going to have to compromise. You're going to walk into a classroom, you're going to know what needs to be done to do the job perfectly, and you're going to have to make your peace with the fact that you are not going to be able to do that, that you don't have enough time, enough hours in the day, enough you to do the job the way it ought to be done in the perfect world.
So you mentioned the compromise. I don't know if Pew asked this question. You asked about relationship with the parents. So one of the things that I live across the street from an elementary school, and on occasion I talk to teachers. One of the teachers who's been around for a while, like 20 years, okay, talked about how different her classroom is today and how the students are different today than they were 20 years ago. But listen to what she was saying. What she was saying is where she would have one or two kids whose parents either have died from an overdose and being raised by grandparents, or had some real tragedy at home. She said that's gone from 2 to 7 sometimes in my classes. So the number of kids that are coming in from such dysfunctional families has just dramatically increased. We had the overdose epidemic here, like West Virginia. This was New Hampshire, and I don't know if it's true other places. But she just said, the challenge in the classroom is that the kids in some ways seem like they need so much more support, that we're getting less support for the kids that we have to deal with. So there are fewer, we need more paras because we have more challenges. And my daughter was saying, Mom, what do you do when a kid comes in hungry and they smell? You know, I mean, you got to feed them, but you also want to give them a bath. I mean, people don't understand. It's not just a classroom where you're going to teach, that you're looking at this whole kid, and the whole kid isn't just what's going to be sitting there learning to read and write. The whole kid is coming in with all these other issues. And then the question is, how does a school respond? And as you pointed out, the compromises. I keep thinking about what the compromises begin with is like, oh my God, I have to be more of a social worker than a teacher. And I'm not sure I was as prepared for that.
No, you're not prepared for that as a teacher. And I mean, you're literally not taught to be a social worker.
Exactly.
And you don't necessarily have the time or resources to do it, nor a lot of our argument these days is about how much teachers and schools should be involved in things beyond teaching the content. We have, again, as we've had cyclically over forever, people saying, well, let's get back to basics. Let's just teach content. And I can sympathize with that, just as I sympathize with teachers who are sitting in a classroom going, I did not go into this field. I went into this field to teach students stuff. I didn't get into this field to become a social worker. And yet, you've got to be able to deal with that stuff at least well enough to get it out of the way of the teaching.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
If they're bringing all of that, all those extra issues into the classroom with them, those become an obstacle to doing the job that you're there.
It's not just that once, I mean, it's kind of like a rotten apple. You put it in the bushel barrel and all the other apples become rotten. So you can't ignore that, well, it's only one student or it's only three students, because that one student in a classroom impacts the whole learning environment in that classroom. So in a lot of ways, people are saying, oh, but it's only one or two kids. And you're looking at them going, excuse me, have you ever been in a classroom with one or two kids? So in a lot of ways, you can't not do it. And let me just share something with you, Peter, because as you pointed out, they didn't tell you that you were going to be a social worker. Well, I think they better start teaching that. And let me tell you why. Many, many years ago, I interviewed a soldier in Afghanistan. And let me tell you what I did. And the reason I interviewed this soldier in Afghanistan is that he was taught to be a military guy, okay? That's what he was taught to do. And you know what he suddenly realized when he got to Afghanistan? He had to be a social worker. He had to be a social worker because there were so many community issues. There were so many other things that he needed to do that it wasn't about a weapon and it wasn't about a bullet and it was about that he had to figure out how to work with that community in order to, one, make himself safe, but also to stabilize the situation. So in a bizarre way, we keep wanting things to be compartmentalized. But when you're talking about people that are living in an environment where they have to be around each other, whether it's in Afghanistan or in a classroom for how many hours a day, schools need so much more support. And if we don't support them, not only does teaching not happen, but in some ways, the stability of the community doesn't happen.
It's hard for the stability of the community. And you do end up, you know, there are student rights that have to be balanced. I mean, you have to worry about dealing with that student who's bringing their difficulties into the classroom. But at the same time, if they're interfering with the education of 20 other students in that room, then that has to be weighed as well. And it becomes difficult calculation, which teachers generally have to do on the fly, because you never know how things are going to go today in the next 5 minutes.
When Pew was doing this survey, one of the things that we've seen intensify or expand is the concept of vouchers and charter schools. So now they're complaining about the fact that they haven't been compensated and they're working harder and they're getting paid less. But there's also an intention here. And the intention is now is that in some ways, there's almost a threat every day in a classroom, Peter, because if the school isn't performing and you now have this very rich voucher program, like if you look at places like Iowa, for example, that, you know, basically wants to expand vouchers to everyone, there is almost a fear of what's happening in your classroom, because if when a kid leaves, it's not like you're still not going to have to pay for that classroom. You're still not going to pay for that teacher, but there are going to be fewer dollars coming into a system that still needs to respond to this diversity of people that have to be educated. Did anyone ask them about what they sort of are experiencing now with the expansion of these vouchers and charter programs and how that's impacting both themselves psychologically and what's happening for them in a classroom?
There isn't a lot about the issues of choice in this particular survey. Yeah. That's not something they got to a lot this time around.
But don't you think they have to, Peter? I mean, I think with what we're seeing with the extent that's happening with vouchers, I mean, look at New Hampshire. You know, we were told it's going to be, you know, maybe $1 million or a couple $100,000. And then it turned out it was like much, much more than that. And there's a constant assault on every aspect of it. And I keep thinking that in some ways we're being naive, as if teachers don't notice what's happening around them. But not only are they noticing what's happening with book banning, and they're noticing what's happening with their paycheck, but they're also noticing what's happening with what's happening in their classroom. If all of a sudden, you know, a kid that's here this year is a kid that's not here next year because their parents were given $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000 to take them out of the public school setting, that has to have an impact on teaching.
I'm sure it has some impact on teaching. I mean, I think in terms of resources, in a place like New Hampshire, where you've gone to universal vouchers, in the states that have seen universal vouchers, this the financial impact even goes beyond that. It's not just the kid who gets $8,000 to leave your classroom. It's the kid who got $8,000 who was never in your classroom in the first place.
Right. Oh, God.
So when you expand universal vouchers so that everybody who already has a kid in private school can collect a voucher, what you've essentially done is you've expanded drastically and immediately the number of students that the taxpayer is funding for education.
Right. You're expanding the number of people. Oh, that's right. Because if they were never in the system, if they were always in private school, if they were always in parochial school, if they were always being homeschooled, we were not responsible for cutting a check. Right. But now with the voucher program, not only, so now you are writing checks to kids that were never within the system. I never even thought of it that way. That's absolutely correct. Oh my God. So I know they haven't asked that question, and that's I think to me a really important question to ask. But what I'm also asking is like, not only are vouchers going to be problematic for what happens with the financial resources of a school, but isn't it going to sort of impact the rural-urban divide? Because in rural places like rural Texas or rural New Hampshire, there aren't a lot of options. I mean, there aren't a lot of private schools you can send your kid to. There aren't a lot of parochial schools. You're rural for a reason, because it's called remote, you know? Yeah. And so the choices that we keep telling parents that we're giving them are choices that might work in a suburban or urban area, but you don't have a choice in rural America. Your public school is your choice, and it's the center of your community.
Yeah, and that's why you've seen, you know, for instance, in Texas, where Greg Abbott pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed for a voucher program and was stymied by members of his own party, all of whom come from rural communities with rural school districts. It depends how large the impact is, depends on how the vouchers are going to be financed. But, you know, in the worst case scenario, you've got a rural school district where nobody attending that school has a choice, because there are no available choice schools in the area, and yet the district is losing state funding because the overall funding is going
exactly
for funding vouchers.
I'm still going back to what you just told me, that we're now paying for kids that have never been in the school system. I know a lot of people like that are now using the vouchers, but it didn't even occur to me. Those are dollars that never had to go to them because they always had the privilege of being able to. It's just, I'm shocked. So other thing that you mentioned in this survey, which I thought was interesting, and I guess my question is, since you cover education, what's the answer? And it was cell phones and other classroom disruptions. And this was no surprise, a whopping 72% of high school teachers report that cell phone distraction is a major problem in their classrooms. And 60% say that enforcing cell phone policies is very or somewhat difficult. So I'm just trying to figure out, has anyone threaded this needle? Has anyone figured out what the H to do?
What they're talking about, the difficulty enforcing it, is what it comes down to in real terms is that moment where you as a teacher turn to a student and say, you know, maybe you've told them twice already, put the phone away. And they've still got it out, so you say, give me the phone.
Right.
And the student says no. Okay, So what do you do next? Do you get into a giant battle of wills with this kid over this device, bringing your class to a screeching halt? Do you send them to the office? Do you call somebody from the office to pull this kid out over a phone? It's a very difficult thing to force compliance on, depending on what the dynamics are in your classroom and in your school.
Why can't you have a basket? And that when they come into class, all the phones go in the basket. And then when they leave class, they get to pick up all their phones. Therefore, their phones are still accessible, technically. They're not next to them, technically. And therefore, there's a level playing field. So you don't have to worry about the one kid not turning their phone off or the one kid paying attention. It's that, you know what? This is the story here. Put your phone in the basket. I'll hold the basket. When you leave, come pick up your phone. Why can't we do something like that? Because if nothing else, and I know a lot of parents are hysterical. They want their kids to have cell phones. I mean, in some ways, the parents are almost worse than the kids. And I think that becomes part of a problem.
And there are some places where the basket works, where the old... The shoe trees with little individual pockets that used to hang
exactly,
on
there. Exactly, exactly.
One for each phone. It's still, depending on the culture of your school, your relationship with your students, how your classroom works, you've still got the challenge of, can you be sure? Because, you know, you're talking about kids carrying around $800, $900,000 devices.
Yes, I know.
So when you take physical custody of that device, now you've got, you know, the kid has handed you $1,000. Can you make sure that it gets back to the kid? Can you, you know, if something happens and it gets busted, whose liability is that? I mean, cell phones are just so many problems in so many ways.
Someone pointed out, this was just so shocking to me. And they said, can I tell you why I want my kid to have a cell phone? And I said, why? She said, because what if there's an active shooter in the school? I want them to have a phone. And to think that that's how you have to think when you put your kid on a bus in the morning and you kiss them goodbye. And the reason that you have in your head that you want them to have a cell phone is that you're worried about the safety and the security in the school, because we've heard about things that have happened in places like Texas and around the country. And I mean, there's a bill now going that's just being introduced in Iowa that wants basically all the teachers and professionals in the school to be able to have guns and to basically be immune from liability. So whether you're inviting in a shooter or you have someone who's weaponized in the school, oh my God, Peter, I never had to think about that when my kids were little, but people are now thinking about that today.
Yeah, it's part of the calculus in a lot of people's minds, and understandably so.
So if Peter Green could do two things to sort of stabilize or fix some of the problems facing public education, we only have 2 minutes left. That's why I'm giving you two things. What would those things be, Peter? I mean, you've been covering this. You think about it. You eat, sleep, and drink it. What is it that if we had to triage sort of the response that we need to give to schools and to teachers, what would that be?
End reliance on the big standardized testing that we started 20-some years ago.
Wow. Good point.
Because that's become the tool of a dozen different problems in public education. So, and that would be my first wave of my magic wand. I guess fixed funding would be the second one.
And what about disconnecting funding from property taxes?
I don't have the policy knowledge to figure out how exactly you could make that work, but there's no question that there has to be that's something we have to address.
Because then accident of geography defines the wealth of the school. And yet every child should have a right to a quality public education, and yet they don't get that right. But I thought your first answer was remarkable, and I totally agree with you. And if you go to those very fancy prep schools, then guess what? They don't have those tests.
Nope.
And on that note, I need to let you go. Peter Green, we need to talk more often. This is something I love. Peter Green writes for Forbes. He also has a blog called Curmudgeon Education. We've been talking about the state of education and teachers based on a new Pew survey. Thank you so much for joining us. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. We'll see you tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You bet.